Yes, we are going pants off for Patreon here for the After Dark with our good
all right. So wait, without further ado, here's my knickknack. So I bought this at a Comic-Con years ago, somewhere back east. I think I bought it in Florida. But I guess someone had taken like the little Funko minifigs that they used to make for the horror series. So this mm-hmm. is the Jack Torrance one. And I think it came with the little typewriter.
Yeah, I see. He's got the little typewriter. He's got his axe.
And then they painted the floor of this thing. And you know, they made it like a, you know, like a bell. Like, I guess like almost like a...
Yeah.
Right? Isn't this a thing? It almost looks sort of like hotel.
Yeah, no, that's like an old timey way of, you know, I think we at the house here, we have like some old like taxidermied butterflies that are in a bell like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. It's got a whole shining feel to it. And then there's
the key. It's very cool.
There's a key to room 237.
Of course. What other room would you give a key to? Yeah.
Phone number for the Colorado, for the Outlook.
That's very cool. I love that.
Tremendous. Yeah. Tremendous. Yeah. Yeah, and so we're here. We're back in the After Dark. We're going to talk about a few more kind of fun, interesting things about Stanley Kubrick. Michael, you brought a lot of passion. It's so cool, like that, just to know that movie exists. Like you can dip into it anytime. It's always there. I think I probably watch it every year.
Oh, 100%.
I watch it often. I've seen it probably a dozen times. Yeah. Yeah.
Have you seen it on the big screen? Have you ever seen it on a big screen?
I had never seen it on the big screen.
I've seen it twice on a big screen.
Oh my God.
It is. I saw the big 4K or 8K or whatever the fuck it was, restoration at the Alamo Drafthouse in New York in Brooklyn years ago. And then I saw it in Chicago in college at Navy Pier.
Hmm.
There's a big movie theater at Navy Pier in Chicago.
Yeah, I know Navy Pier. Yeah.
And it was for like, it was like a Halloween screening, and they did a screening of The Shining, and it looked grainy and fun, but the one I saw at Alamo was so crystal clear. It was insane. It was like, it was mind blowing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm really remiss to say that I haven't seen it on the big screen. I've got to make that happen. That's for me a bucket list thing. Yeah.
You know, I've never seen a Kubrick film on the big screen. Now that I think about it.
Oh my God. I've seen 2001. I saw 2001 at the LACMA.
Okay.
When they did that, did you guys see? So you didn't see the Stanley Kubrick exhibit that they toured around the world.
I did. Kevin, I saw it in
Kevin
London.
Saw that.
Oh yes. Shit! Okay, and so I saw that at the LACMA, and that was the most amazing.
Awesome.
The rooms of like unfinished projects and like all the stuff, all the information about it. That was great.
They had the typewriter for a different movie.
Yeah.
Yep. They had the typewriter. I got to see, and I mentioned this on the core episode. On accident, the one day that I happened to be there, I was over in London to see Dead Can Dance, which is one of my favorite musical groups. The day before, I just happened to be at this exhibition because a producer friend of mine, like a theater friend of mine, said, you got to go see that. And Jocelyn Pookin and her ensemble were there. And I walked out of the and she's the person who created the music that is so iconic from Eyes Wide Shut. There was a period actually when Brad and I were in grad school where I was obsessed with her music, and I was like writing to her music and everything. And I walked out of the Kubrick exhibition and I heard the sound of the music being played, and I'm like, wait a minute. And there she was with her ensemble.
Eyes Wide Shut room.
they were actually in the lobby, and they were warming up to do a show. So I stuck around and saw them warm up. It was very, very cool. Yeah, but that exhibition, if you ever get a chance to see that, that is for anybody who appreciates Kubrick a must.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it'll come
you
back.
You walk
around,
in
I'm
on
sure.
the carpet from The Shining, you can see the masks from Eyes Wide Shut. They have the typewriter. They have
I will tell you though, I've seen Clockwork on the big screen, I've seen Full Metal Jacket. I've seen the ones starting with 2001. I've seen all of them on a big screen somewhere. Not the earlier pre-2001s, but the best, I will tell you, the best one I saw on a big screen was 2001.
Yeah.
There is nothing like it. I mean, they showed it at the LACMA. It was like showed it in 70 millimeter with the intermission, with the whole thing, with the overture. That is a singular experience as a moviegoer watching that film. It is absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
It's amazing how all of his movies hold up in some way. Like they don't look dated. They don't look
not at all.
They just feel so prescient all the time, no matter what it is.
Including the great Eyes Wide Shut.
Go. The shitty experience I had in a movie theater watching a Stanley Kubrick movie. Wait, that was the year, by the way, that year will go down in such infamy for me as a moviegoer, because it was Eyes Wide Shut and Phantom Menace. And I was like, fuck both things that I love. It was like the ten poles of my childhood and my like upbringing as a cinephile were Star Wars and Kubrick. And they fucked them both up in one year. Like,
Never recovered.
sorry, Phantom Menace fans.
Are there Phantom Menace fans?
I don't know if there's got to be Menace fans.
For me, it didn't work, but you know,
I didn't. Yeah,
our Patreon. Thank you, Patreon subscribers. Very cool things coming, including the book club. If you want to be part of the book club, get ahead of reading Heart of Darkness, Joseph Conrad, coming out in January. Okay, I have the resolution with Helena in the toy store.
Okay.
All right. So let's dig into this a little bit. Then we'll come back to The Shining. A substory that at first glance appears to be fairly disturbing occurs at the end of Eyes Wide Shut and is largely obscured within the film's capstone conversation between Bill and Alice. As Bill and Alice talk, he's questioning her about what they should do. They settle in an aisle framed with stuffed bears and tigers. Beyond them are two men looking at one of the bear toys. Helena enters the camera frame and briefly stands between her parents as the men replace the bear on the shelf in an area where it doesn't appear to belong, amidst a row of bears of another style. These two men beyond, the shorter, a balding man with glasses and in a grayish coat, the taller, a balding man in a dark coat, resemble two men observed at Victor's holiday party. They are both first seen, the taller man first, then the shorter in the glasses, following after Bill and Alice as they progress down the hall to enter the room with the great stairway, having just arrived at the party. As Victor and his wife speak to Bill and Alice, these two men and the women with them are observed also entering and leaving that area, the man with the glasses having always attracted this writer's attention as he figures into the crossfade to the ballroom scene following. He steps forward to greet a woman in the hall to the ballroom, and Alice and Bill follow after him. The man in the glasses who plays with the bear at the toy store doesn't just resemble but appears to be the same man as at Victor's. His companion at the toy store may also be the same one who was his companion at Victor's, but we're less certain, although they do share this sort of same look.
Is this the guy who was following him on the street as well as one of those two guys?
I don't think it is. But it's a similar vibe of guy, right? If you rewatch this, and I don't want you to torture yourself, Michael, but if you rewatch
this. You know what's fucked up is I'm actually going to go back after this today, and I'm actually going to like look for it.
Right. So if just a few more pairs here. They, unlike the majority of Kubrick's extras, are positioned to stand out. Examining the bear in the toy store, the pair draw attention as they are centered in the middle of the frame between Bill and Alice and above Helena. They stand out at Victor's party as when Bill is taken up to Victor's bathroom, there's a Christmas tree on the left, we see them seated beneath the statue of the Angel's Kiss at the foot of the stairs. The why of these two men seated at the foot of the Angel's Kiss statue with two women when Bill is led up the stairs to Victor's bathroom has, and this is speaking as this writer, always puzzled me because it meant they were placed to prominently stand out. But why? Now they show up at the store. We wouldn't think much of this, except that as Helena moves beyond her parents in the store to look at the bear the two men have replaced on the shelf, that action having attracted her attention, there also enters an individual from the right who appears to be a waiter who was numerous times observed while Sandor was finessing Alice by the bar at Victor's. He is the same waiter who served Alice her champagne as she exited the dance to go to the bathroom.
Wait, that guy's in the toy store?
Yes.
Come on.
But but here is what is most disorienting and troubling about the scene. Little Helena looks back at Bill and Alice as she follows behind the two older men. Helena faces away from Alice and Bill, bypassing the bear to follow the two men. And the man who was the waiter steps forward between the parents and the girl. Then Kubrick cuts to an extreme close-up of Alice turning away and giving her complete attention to Bill. That is the last we see of Helena. So
I didn't catch any of that.
Oh yeah,
it means it takes a village to kidnap. Is basically what you're saying.
Yeah,
you really don't need that many people to kidnap a small child, right? I mean, not that I have experience doing that, but I just feel like one person.
Doesn't seem that hard.
Yeah,
right. Get some candy.
One child. Yeah, get candy, a cozy van.
Get a van with a dragon on the side. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I just wonder what, so like the idea is that like Bill is actually going to pay for it.
Right.
For doing that, for going outside of his comfort zone. Like what's the idea?
Yeah. Or there's this weird implication that they may, I think it could be multiple things, but that's certainly probably Occam's razor would be they're not convinced that he's going to shut up. So they're going to really make him feel it. And it was not a dream. It was real. Mm-hmm. Whether or not.
Which goes back to The Shining. It's all real.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah. And even if it was a dream echoing the holiday party, if he was sort of sleeping and dreaming about his anxiety about what had happened at the party, the consequences of it are nevertheless real. That's why it's called Eyes Wide Shut, I think. And at the very end, they don't even see it. So there's also an even more sinister possibility that they're maybe looking away themselves. Although that would be extraordinarily dark. I don't think that's quite as justified, but it plays in that nebulous arena.
A lot of that has to do with, though, it's like you don't see, not to be like too on the nose about it, it's like you don't see what's literally right in front of your face half the time. Like you don't, like you have this, you're married to this woman, you have this job, you know these people, but like none of it, it's all based on your perception of yourself and how you fit into it. Right.
Yes.
Because there are times when, like, not to get too personal, but like I think there are times in marriage and in fatherhood for myself where it's like I think I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and then I'm reminded that
I have no idea what's happening.
Like sometimes you're just sort of like slapped in the face and realize that your perception of how things are going or you never actually know how anyone else feels or thinks except for what they tell you.
Right
Well, and if indeed the daughter is kidnapped there, it makes the final lines all that more ironic. We should be grateful. You know what we need to do? Fuck.
Right.
it makes it all stand out even more. I think it's creepy. It's a creepy movie, and that movie has lots of sort of weird and sinister things in it.
Sure.
On a level, I think.
Mm-hmm. Including Tom Cruise, just as a human being.
It is my favorite Tom Cruise movie. And I personally think that it's a case of like, it makes it better knowing that he's all up with the Scientologists and all the rest, because that movie is very much about some.
Yeah.
Sort of,
well, yeah, there is a sense when he walks into that sex ritual where like, Tom Cruise has probably been to dozens of these. Like,
right.
Except all men, let's be honest. That's why Tom Cruise is in Scientology.
Oh boy.
He's suppressing his homosexuality. Yeah. That's what's going on in Scientology. It just feels like people suppressing like who they really are because they feel like they can't come to terms with it based on religion or societal upbringing and all that stuff. It's just all about secrets, right?
Right.
Jeez, I didn't
have
a
good lawyer.
No, I would think so. Yeah.
Do you know any good lawyers, Michael?
Yeah, are they going to come through the window and kill me?
Well, they got to get on Patreon first to hear that. So.
I saw a funny joke about why Tom Cruise has aged so well, because he has physically aged, you know, and who knows, surgery and whatever. But somebody said, well, he cleared his thetan decades ago. Of course he's
naturally.
What do you mean?
It seem, though, in the career of Tom Cruise that, like, there was that moment where he's like married to Nicole Kidman and working with Stanley Kubrick where he could have gone the route of not crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like it seemed like he was almost like thinking about maybe I shouldn't be in science. Maybe that was his whole, like, I can't imagine Scientology was like super excited about him working with Stanley Kubrick and doing a movie like that. It doesn't fit in with his whole image and the image of that organization. It certainly doesn't make any, like you said, it makes that organization look even more sinister and weird and creepy. So I just wonder if that was like, that was the inflection point where Cruise could have gone straight or he could have gone deeper into the cult, and he went deeper into the cult.
Yeah, because after that, everything was, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I guess Vanilla Sky maybe would be an exception. After that, it was all popcorn movies, right? Mm-hmm. Basically.
Right around that time, because he did Jerry Maguire.
Yeah.
Which was kind of a revival for him. Which, by the way, is an awesome, that's my favorite Tom Cruise movie, Jerry Maguire. I happen to really like
it. Yeah, it's a good movie. Yeah.
I just like the movie. I don't know about him per se. No, my favorite Tom Cruise movie is Magnolia. That's my favorite performance.
You can't forget Tropic Thunder.
Epic Thunder, too.
Yeah, that doesn't hold up necessarily with both people of color and Jews. Oh, not a great. Let's tread lightly on that one.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, Tom Cruise plays a real likable character, like a real not anti-Semitic character in that movie.
your love and respect for Tom Cruise only grows.
Oh, what a weirdo. Anyway,
he is a weirdo. I think that is.
No, but I think Magnolia was right after Eyes Wide Shut. It was like 2000.
It was around that, yeah.
That's so like that was sort of the pinnacle of dark characters, where he did Eyes Wide Shut, Magnolia, and I think right after Magnolia, when he didn't win the Oscar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, popcorn all, movies like said, yeah. that are just
then it was like, Mission Impossible,
right?
Constantly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah, yeah. Just playing the hero.
It became a Tom Cruise podcast.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to. I had a link here. Oh, here. This is so. We'll get into a few more fun facts as we sort of wind down, but. The Shining possibly did more single takes of a close-up than any other movie ever. Stanley Kubrick was a notorious perfectionist who got double-digit takes of basically every angle. And while it allowed him to bring all of the footage he could ever need to the edit bay, it was an exhausting process for the actors, I can't imagine. No scene in The Shining better exemplifies this than the one featuring Halloran and Danny sitting in the kitchen discussing their special gifts. The shot of the two of them together took something in the realm of 88 takes, and the close-up of Scatman Crothers took 148.
Oh my God.
Apparently, this is maybe the most done cuts for a close-up ever.
Jeez.
Oh. Now,
What's a typical, Michael, when you're filming, what do you expect it to be if you're on set? How many times do you shoot an angle, say, or something? I mean, it's more than one, right? You would be expected.
Yeah, it so has to do with the medium you're working in. So like I just did, you know, the top procedural on TV, which was FBI, right, for CBS. So like on that, they have to shoot, 20 something episodes in a certain amount of time. And so they just don't have the time to shoot a bunch of stuff. And they have to tell a pretty long story with multiple locations per episode. Meanwhile, they're like shooting the next episode. And sometimes they're shooting out the previous episode. And on a film, you know, generally speaking, in terms of most budgets, you know, directors don't have that sort of auteur kind of control that Stanley Kubrick has. So, you know, sometimes I think for my money, like someone like Steven Soderbergh is probably one of, if not right, of maybe the best living director. And here's a guy who I think is very heavily influenced by Kubrick among other sort of more Hollywood directors. He's a big Spielberg fan. Like he likes a lot of different things, but you'd think that like, you think of Soderbergh as like a great master of film. I mean, that guy doesn't do more than two or three takes tops,
even
for really intense scenes. And like, he just doesn't believe in it. Like he's very confident. He knows what he wants. He knows what he needs to get out of a scene and he does it. So I think it's very rare. Mm. It's a very rare occurrence. And I think, I'm trying to think of other filmmakers whose work that I've watched that makes me think, oh, I'm sure they did a million takes. Like maybe Paul Thomas Anderson. Mm. I would feel like someone like that would do a lot. I don't want to speak. He's like the one guy I'd love to work with. I don't know, but I would say in my experience working with, I've worked with some big directors and I've worked with lots of indie directors and all over the map. It has to do with how much power and control you have. But even when you have that power and control, some directors just don't need it and don't want it and feel like they want to stay loose and keep their actors loose. You know, that's the one thing that it can kill. It can kill the energy on a set. So it kind of depends on what you're shooting, you know, and what you're trying to convey through the lens in terms of the energy of your piece. So I have, it's run the gamut for me.
Right on.
Sure.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that's insane. But what, I mean, that's why people talk about Kubrick now, because nobody, you know.
Yeah.
Scorsese shoots a shit ton. He does. Sure. He shoots a lot.
Yeah.
there are great directors who still do that, but they're few and far between.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Well, this is a bit of a tangent. Then we'll come back to the set of The Shining, and then I think we'll wind down. But this is Quentin Tarantino on Kubrick. So now Tarantino claimed that, I think, which one was it? Killer's Kiss? One of the early movies influenced Reservoir Dogs. We talk about that on our core episode.
Is Killer Kiss the one about the boxer? I think that's the one. One of them was influenced the Pulp Fiction thing.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with Kubrick's like noirish stuff. I know them very peripherally.
They're worth watching. I mean, Killer's Kiss, the cover has a dude holding an axe, like the poster. Yeah, you know, so if you watch that early stuff, you can kind of see he's already he's there. He's fully realized at a very early age. But by the time he arrived at Paths of Glory, it was like, wow, this is Paths of Glory is just absolutely
awesome. That's dark. That's a dark movie.
That movie's incredible. But here's Tarantino. Let me see here. I just got to find my link. I've got too many things open. Paths of Glory is just like, you watch it, it's like a Renaissance painting. It's staggeringly good. Talking about which scenes?
The war scenes, the way he shot.
Yeah. Well, so Tarantino has little respect for Kubrick's refusal to lean into things the way that Tarantino does in terms of violence. So in a 2003 interview with The New Yorker, Tarantino complained about what he saw as a hypocritical worldview in Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange. "I always thought Kubrick was a hypocrite," Tarantino said, "because his party line was, 'I'm not making a movie about violence. I'm making a movie against violence.'" Tarantino added, "Get the fuck out. I know you and your dick was hard the entire time you were shooting those first 20 minutes. You couldn't keep it in your pants the entire time you were editing it and scoring it."
Wow. I guess he might have a point, but also like Tarantino's just, I love Tarantino films too, but like not everybody, that's a little bit of projection, right? You know what I mean? It's like Tarantino's like, if the movie doesn't have an exploding torso in it, is it really a movie?
The difference between those two guys though is that like Tarantino is directly influenced by the exploitation movies in the 1970s. He saw them as a kid, became obsessed with them, and that's all he makes, whether it's a Western exploitation movie. You know, he plays in all these different genres, but it's all
exploitation.
Very films, specific style of filmmaking that directly is influenced by his childhood. So like, who was Kubrick influenced by? Like those movies, that I think that's the singular genius of someone like Stanley Kubrick, where he makes Clockwork Orange. What movie could you possibly compare that to that came before it? None.
He
invented
very few, if any,
multiple genres of movies. So like, shut up, Quentin. Although I love you so much. I love him so hard. I'm reading his book. I love him. I love almost everything he's ever done, like hard. Mm-hmm. But come on. Yeah. I mean, there is that disconnect between what Kubrick puts on film and how much you feel it is from him, or how much you feel like he directs at a distance. Mm-hmm. And I think he does direct at a distance because it's so composed. And it's so thought out, you know, it's not like Tarantino, who shoots from the hip and is messier and has more fun.
Well, that's the criticism of Kubrick. If you ever hear it, it's that he's too cerebral. He's too formal on all of those criticisms. I happen to think that's bullshit, but I can also understand. It's like the most obvious
kind of thing. It's just like talking about different kinds of music, different composers, different painters, like everybody. You can't compare what Andy Warhol does to Picasso or to an impressionist painter. Like it's all really interesting and valid and worth taking a look at. But I find that very odd when filmmakers start ragging on each other and talking about that kind of stuff, because also you can't speak to the context of the time, of the attitudes, of the budgets. Like it's just a whole other ball of wax. I think it's a hard thing to really, it's like apples and oranges, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed.
I think you're totally right.
All right. One little final reading. And this is about, this is from The Independent. "Making The Shining was hell. How tormented stars, Kubrick's temper, and box office disaster led to an immortal horror." So I'm just going to read a few paras here. "Jack Nicholson must have needed a lot of toothpaste. When he was starring in Kubrick's horror movie, The Shining, he felt it a matter of common courtesy to brush his teeth before any new scene. Working on a Kubrick film was, he thought, grueling enough anyway for the crew and his fellow actors without having him breathe all over them through a face full of lamb cutlets." In her BBC documentary, Making The Shining, Vivian Kubrick, the director's daughter, shows Nicholson bent over the base and rinsing his mouth. The moment the ritual was complete, he would very politely walk back on set, picked up the axe, and started trying to hack his co-star Shelley Duvall into pieces all over again with that demented grin on his face. there was take after take after take, and his breath was as fresh as the end of the day as at the beginning. So a few more here. Let's see.
Tips for actors.
Yeah.
Let's see here. I want to get into some. There's a little bit. Okay. The director's fastidious approach has given fuel to all these conspiracy theorists who've been poring over every frame of the film ever since it was released. The production design and use of props are so detailed that fans have read secret messages in everything from the tinned food in the Overlook's larders to the pictures on the walls. And the colors, color of Jack's typewriter changes in the course of the movie. These fans won't accept it could be a simple continuity error. They're sure Kubrick is telling them something. I love that.
I don't think there are any accidents in the movie. I don't think he's telling anything specific by doing that, but he is doing that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Nothing that's in that frame that is accidental.
Right. So here's just a little more about the treatment of the actors. The auteur defended his actions by talking about how it happens when actors are unprepared when quizzed about the onset demands. Detailing further, Kubrick added, "You cannot act without knowing dialogue. If actors have to think about the words, they can't work on the emotions. You end up doing 30 takes of something, and still, you can see the concentration in their eyes. They don't know their lines, so you just shoot it and hope you can get something out of it in pieces." The onset stories for the film are now a thing of Hollywood whispers. From Jack Nicholson being fed cheese sandwiches that he loathed for 2 weeks straight to unleash the madman in him, to Danny Lloyd inventing the iconic finger waggle himself, the filmmaking history is littered with wild trivia. However, there lay some dark secrets as well, especially involving the film lead Shelley Duvall, who played Jack Torrance's wife and Scream Queen Wendy. Stephen King admittedly hated Kubrick's adaptation, especially the characterization of Wendy, which, according to him, was a misogynistic portrayal of a character that was totally different from the one he had written in the book. I did not know that business about the cheese sandwiches.
Yeah.
That feels a little false.
Yeah.
What knows? Does?
As if that would be, you know.
I'm gonna drive you insane by giving you a cheese sandwich every day. I guess it could. Yeah, I don't know.
One more little bit about Duvall. Kubrick supposedly did not print anything until at least the 35th take. Duvall's role was extremely tiresome, as she would have to run around carrying Lloyd, crying and screaming for 35 takes. To be in the correct state of mind, Duvall would induce emotional pain and sorrow by listening to sad songs on her Walkman and reliving unhappy memories. She was MK-Ultraing herself. Even then, she said, it was difficult to do the above-mentioned activity as her body would refuse to comply, and that sometimes made her cry. You just think about something very sad in your life or how much you miss your family or friends, she said in a recent interview with Hollywood Reporter. But after a while, your body rebels. It says, stop doing this to me. I don't want to cry every day. And sometimes just that thought alone would make me cry. Duvall found it extremely laborious to wake up on a Monday morning and cry all day, according to schedule. Her plight garnered sympathy from the cast and crew, especially her co-star Jack Nicholson, who allegedly said, I don't know how you do it. According to Nicholson, Kubrick was a completely different director when around Duvall. So as we covered on the core, she would later admit that it made her a better actor, but that was quite a powerful, like an intense, difficult shoot.
Yeah absolutely.
You never know. I can tell you from experience, you never really know what goes on behind the scenes and like who's difficult, how they're difficult. You know, it's unfortunate that he has a reputation, he has as a director, and then like his daughter shot that thing and there's those little bits of film where, you know, Kubrick's yelling, come on, Shelley, we're all waiting for you and blah, blah, blah. And can't you hear your cue? But I will tell you that like, I work with so many actors and like they do like missing a cue and not listening and not being tuned in and not like, there are so many times when actors they fuck stuff up for directors and sometimes we don't remember. I try to. Every time, I will say that is one of the things I do really work hard at. But, you know, I think a lot of times you don't realize like you're just a cog in a machine and there's so much money and everybody's time. And like there has to be a certain uber level of professionalism and passion and whatever it is to like be in the moment and just be ready for anything. But
yeah, it's a job. I mean, it's ultimately a, a job, or there's at least an aspect.
It's a very hard job.
Yeah,
people think it's glamorous, but it's hard.
I'm not defending abusive directors, by the way. Nobody should be subjected to any abuse.
You remember, like, when Christian Bale, that whole thing, Christian Bale yelling at some people on I don't know if it was a grip or a lighting guy or something, yelling at some guy, and that came out virally. And I remember listening to that, and be like, I don't know, it kind of sounds like that prop guy was an asshole. Like,
Christian Bale would agree that, like, he probably didn't handle it the best way, but also like, you're dealing with $100 million movie and like all this time and effort and everything, and you're just like, everyone just needs to operate on a very professional level at all times, and when you don't, it sticks out like a sore thumb, and it can be. And also, everybody's like passions and tensions are so high, especially you're doing something like Terminator with Christian Bale, or you're doing The Shining. Like, everyone's already in that heightened state, you know? And like,
And 12, 14, 16 hour days or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, crazier shit, I'm sure, has happened in plays and movies and all sorts of things in the history. Yeah. I think the issue with that movie and with him in general is that, like, there was just no oversight. Like, the keys to the kingdom were given to these male auteur directors, and basically everyone was scared to say anything, or like, there was no, you know, there's nobody there to be like a coordinator of people's feelings, and they have that for every single aspect of filmmaking now. It's a little overkill, but also, like, it's good that people can, like, feel protected and, you know, have a voice if they are abused, because
It's good to have some guardrails.
Well, I like to think of myself as the auteur of Art of Darkness, and I am very, very difficult for Brad. I make it very hard for him sometimes.
Help.
Link twice if you need
help.
Michael Nathanson, Playing Dead Podcast. Michael, you are welcome on the pod anytime. If there is a core episode we do, if there's something you want to talk about, you just ping us. We might even reach out to you. We love having recurring guests. This was great. Yeah, I hope you had a good time.
So much fun.
I love talking about this stuff. Yeah, it's why we're here, you know, to like, I don't know, just keep watching this stuff over.
Yeah, right. Man, it's exciting.
It drills down into what really matters very quickly. Art, creativity, passion, psychology, history. That's why we do this pod. And and please, I do encourage our Patreon listeners to go check out Playing Dead. Michael, I wish you very happy holidays, happy new year. And thank you.
Happy holidays to you guys too. Appreciate you having me on.
Of course, man. All right. It's such a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
We'll drop this soon.
All right.
All right. Later, buddy. Take care.